In the last two lectures, we talked about first-order differential operators. And so in red, here's a summary. First, we talked about the gradient. That's this nabla symbol placed next to a scalar function t. So we should think of the gradient as a machine. It takes as its input the scalar function, and it as its output, it produces a vector function, of position, a vector field. And then next, we talked about the divergence. That's the same nabla symbol, but using a dot product to act on a vector field v. And the input of the divergence function is a vector function. The output is a scalar function, s, but it's a different scalar function from the one you started with. S is not equal to t. And then finally, we talked about the curl. And so there's the nabla symbol again, but this time it's going to act with a cross product on some vector field v, and it's going to produce a different vector field w. Today, we're going to talk about second order differential operators. And at first sight, it looks like there will be nine of them, because for the first differential operator, you can choose the gradient or the divergence or the curl. And for the second operator, you can choose again the gradient or the divergence or the curl. So it looks like there will be 3 times 3 or 9 operators, but you'll see some of these operators are impossible. They don't make any sense. And some of them are zero. And so we'll find out that there are only 3 second order differential operators. Okay, let's take a look and see what happens. Well, the first one we can start with is the gradient. And so the gradient acts on a scalar function. So start with a scalar function t. Take the gradient of it. That is a vector. And so what can you do with a vector field? That is to say, the gradient of t is a vector field v. What can you do with this vector field in the box? Well, you can take its divergence or you can take its curl. So let's take the divergence first. The divergence of the gradient of t is written this way. It is del dot, del acting on t. So del dot del occurs so often that this has its own symbol and its own name. Del dot del is written del squared, and sometimes it's written just delta. So you flip the triangle, flip the nabla over so it looks like a delta. I don't recommend this notation because this looks like change in t, and that is definitely not what is meant here. So let's stick to the first convention. Let's use del squared. And the name of this second order differential operator is the Laplacian. The divergence of the gradient is nothing other than the Laplacian. If you think of the Laplacian as a machine, then it is the composite of the gradient machine followed by the divergence machine. And so the input is one scalar function t. The output is a different scalar function, s. So the Laplacian takes a scalar field to a different scalar field. Let's see what the Laplacian looks like in Cartesian coordinates. So start with a scalar field t. First take its gradient. The gradient of t is also written this way, nabla acting on t. And in Cartesian coordinates, the t is a function of x, y, and z. The gradient has a particularly simple form in Cartesian coordinates. It's just the derivative of t with respect to x, partial derivative, multiplied by ex hat, and then the partial derivative of the scalar function t with respect to y, multiplied by ey hat, and then finally partial of t with respect to z, multiplied by ez hat, and add those three terms together. And now I need to take the divergence of that. That was just the first part. That was the gradient of t in the blue box. Now I need to take the divergence of the gradient of t. So this is another copy of the nabla operator in Cartesian coordinates, and I need to take the dot product with the gradient of t in the second blue box. But you can see there's an ex in the first term and a dot product. So when that ex in the left term acts on the ex over here, ex dot ex is just 1. But ex dot ey is 0 and ex dot ez is 0. And so the only non-zero term involving the x's is this first one, d by dx, acting on this, d by dx of t. So altogether, two derivatives of t, rather, with respect to x squared. And then something similar happens. The second term involves an EY hat. When you take the dot product with EX, you'll get zero. Dot product with EY with itself, you'll get one. And EY dot EZ will give you zero. And so the only term remaining is this. It's one factor of D by DY from the first term, another factor of D by DY in the second set of parentheses. So altogether, two partial derivatives with respect to Y of the scalar function T. And the same thing happens for the Z component. EZ dot EX is zero, EZ dot EY is zero, EZ dot EZ is one. And so you get second partial derivative with respect to Z of T, and then add those together. And that's a scalar. There are no hats left over. All the E hat X, Ys, and Zs either gave zero in the dot product or gave factors of one in the dot product. But in any case, there are no vectors left in the answer. And so the Laplacian of the scalar function T is another scalar function. This last thing in the blue box is what I was calling S. That's the scalar function S. This is what the Laplacian looks like in spherical polar coordinates. I'm only writing this because we're going to do an example in a few slides. Again, don't memorize it. When you need it, look it up in a book. And I won't even read it to you, but it's sufficiently complicated. It involves the second partial derivatives. Okay, so the other operation you can do on the gradient, since the gradient of T is a vector, the other thing you can do besides taking the divergence of it is take the curl. And what happens if you try to take the curl of the gradient of T written this way? So it's del cross, del acting on T. Well, you get zero, regardless of what the scalar function T is, as long as it's sufficiently smooth, you'll get zero for all T that you pick. Here is the proof. The gradient of T is a vector, and that's this vector in the last line. So if we scroll up a little bit, in blue, this is where we calculated the gradient of the scalar function T. So I just copied those components. The X component is dt by dx, that goes in this slot. The Y component is dt by dy, that goes down here. The last component is dt by dz, that goes down here. So the last line is the gradient of T. And then these vertical lines represent a determinant. And so the first row are the unit vectors in Cartesian coordinates. The second row are the partial derivatives with respect to x, y, and z. And the last row is whatever vector you put in here, whatever vector you want to take the curl of. And so these are the vector components of the gradient of T. And now let's see what happens. Let's just look at the x component. So method of cofactors. The 2x2 submatrix that goes along with EX is obtained by crossing out the first row and crossing out the first column. And this 2x2 submatrix is what I have left. So I need to take the determinant of this thing in the blue box. So you take the main diagonal with a plus sign and the other diagonal with a minus sign. This says start with the partial of T with respect to Z. That's written here. But then take the y derivative of that. So first take the z derivative, then take the y derivative. But then the off-diagonal terms say do the same operations in the opposite order. Start with the partial derivative of t with respect to y, that's written here. And then take the partial derivative with respect to z, that's written here. And when you take the off-diagonal terms, there's a minus sign that goes with them. But look at these terms. Here I have... first, the partial with respect to z, and then with respect to y. Over here, the opposite order, first the partial with respect to y, then the partial with respect to z. And if the function t is smooth and continuous, and in physics those conditions are always met, then the mixed partial derivatives are equal to each other. So this first term is exactly the same as the second term, and when you subtract them, you'll get nothing. I should warn you, you can construct pathological functions with discontinuities in them where this doesn't hold. But like I said, in physics, that never occurs. So in physics, the mixed partials are always equal to each other. But the same thing will happen in the y direction and in the z direction. And so you wind up getting ex times 0 plus ey times 0 plus ez times 0. And so 0 vector. That is 0 in the x direction plus 0 in the y direction plus 0 in the z direction. Regardless of whatever smooth function t that you start with. So you don't have to worry about this combination. The curl of the gradient is always equal to zero in physics. Okay, so that takes care of everything you can do with the gradient. Remember, the gradient of t was a vector, so you can take its divergence and get the Laplacian, or you can take its curl and get zero. Now let's look at the next first order operator. You can take the divergence. The divergence has to act on some vector field, so start with V. Take the divergence of V, that's a scalar field. The only thing you can do to a scalar field is take its gradient. You can't take the curl of a scalar field, and you can't take the divergence of a scalar field. The only thing you can do to the scalar field in the blue box is take its gradient. And so written with a Nabla symbol, that would be like this. Del dot V is the divergence of V, and then a del written outside takes the gradient of that. This combination does not have any other name. You just have to call it the gradient of the divergence. And the output is some other vector field that I called U. So I started with one vector field V, and when I take the gradient of the divergence of V, I wind up with another vector field U. Okay, and that's all you can do with the divergence. And then the last first order operator is the curl. The curl returns a vector field, and so we can do two things to the curl. Okay, so start with a vector field V. The curl of V is another vector field. I can take its divergence or I can take its curl. So let's start with the first one. Let's take the divergence of the curl of V. I'm going to prove to you that the divergence of the curl of V is always equal to zero, regardless of whatever vector field V that you choose. All right, let's see how that works. This is how you take the curl of the vector field V. I'm going to use Cartesian coordinates, but what I say is going to be true in any coordinate system. So the curl of V is this determinant between the vertical lines. The first row are the unit vectors, ex, ey, ez. The second row are the partial derivatives, d by dx, d by dy, d by dz. The last row are the components of this vector field V, so the x component, the y component, the z component. Take the determinant of that 3x3 matrix. We did this already in one of the previous lectures when we discussed the curl, so I copied the result down here. And now I want to take the divergence of that. I want to take the divergence of everything in this blue box. And that is written this way. This is the divergence of the curl of V. So I need to take the derivative with respect to X of everything in this box, the derivative of Y with respect to everything in the middle box, including the negative sign. That negative sign got copied down right here. And then finally, the partial with respect to Z of everything in this last box, which got copied down here. And let's follow one of the terms. So here I have the Z component of the original vector field V. First, I take its Y derivative, and then I take its X derivative. But if you follow the red arrow, I have the same Z component of the vector field, but this time I take the X derivative first and the Y derivative second. And there's a minus sign between them. And so these two terms connected by the red arrows cancel. This other pair of terms connected by red arrows cancel. And finally, the third pair of terms connected by the red arrows cancel. Again, in physics, the mixed partial derivatives are always equal to each other. One comes in with a plus sign, one comes in with a minus sign. And so all these six terms cancel and give you zero. So I don't have to worry about the divergence of the curl of V. That's always equal to zero. And the last thing I can do to the curl of V, which is a vector field, I can take its curl. And so here I have the curl of the curl of V. That doesn't have any special name or symbol. You just have to call it the curl of the curl. And this is a machine that starts with one vector field V and returns a different vector field that I called A. So of the original nine possibilities, there are only three that are non-zero. So let's scroll back and summarize them. One second order differential operator, a very important one, is the Laplacian. And remember, the Laplacian is the divergence of the gradient of some scalar function t. You're going to see that a lot in this course. The other non-zero combination is this. This is the gradient of the divergence of some vector field V, which returns a different vector field U. This one is not so common, but it still occurs. And the third second order operator is this, the curl of V, which produces another vector field A. So there are only three second order operators to worry about. All right, next I'd like to show you that the Laplacian of this function, 1 over R, is a remarkable function. So let's take a look at it. This function occurs, by the way, very often in electrostatics. We did an example before where I showed you the voltage for a point charge Q at the origin was 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught Q over R. And so the R dependence is 1 over R. Let's take a look at it and see what happens. All right, what is the divergence of this scalar function 1 over R? So now I have to find that line that I didn't read to you, but that I copied for reference. So I need this. I need the Laplacian of some scalar function T written in spherical polar coordinates R, theta, and phi. Well, 1 over R only depends on R. So I need the first term because T is going to be 1 over R. But there will be no theta dependence. And so when I take the theta derivatives, I'll get nothing. And there is no phi dependence. And so when I take the phi derivatives, that term will get knocked out as well. So really, I just need the first one in the blue box. And that's what I copied down below. That's this. So to take the Laplacian of 1 over R, you start at the inside and work your way out. So the first thing I have to do is take the derivative of 1 over R with respect to R. When you're done taking that derivative, then you multiply by R squared. Then you take another derivative with respect to R, and finally divide by 1 over R squared, okay, in that order. And because there are no other functions, there's no theta and there's no phi, I can convert these partial derivatives with respect to R into full derivatives with respect to R. Okay, let's work our way from the inside out. What is the derivative with respect to R of 1 over R? Well, that's negative 1 over R squared. And then I need to multiply that by R squared. So negative 1 over R squared times R squared is negative 1. And then I need to take another derivative with respect to R, but that's easy because negative 1 is a constant. The derivative of negative 1 with respect to R is just 0. And then finally, I need to divide by 1 over R squared. And so the answer to the question, what is the Laplacian of 1 over R? The answer is it's 0 divided by R squared. Now that looks like 0, but you have to be careful. As long as you're not at the origin, as long as R itself is not 0, then you will have 0 on the top divided by some non-zero positive number in the bottom, and 0 divided by something positive will give you 0, as long as you're not at the origin. But if you are sitting at the origin, then R itself is 0, and 0 divided by 0 is undefined. So next we're going to figure out what this function is. But whatever it is, the Laplacian of 1 over R, this remarkable function, whatever it is, it's concentrated at the origin. As long as you're not at the origin, it's equal to 0. But if you are sitting at the origin, then it's something else. We're going to figure out what that something else is using the divergence theorem, also known as Gauss's theorem or Ostrogradsky's theorem. And to remind you, we saw this in a previous lecture, but the triple integral over some open volume V of the divergence of some vector field V is equal to the two-dimensional integral over a closed surface S that bounds the open volume V of the vector field V dotted into a little infinitesimal area and then integrated over the surface. Okay, remember, when you perform the second integral, you're integrating only over the boundary. You're integrating only over the surface, not the interior. For the vector function V, this could be anything. You could pick anything for V on the left and on the right. I'm going to pick the gradient of 1 over R. That's going to be my V that I plug into both slots. And this open volume is up to you, can be anything, and S is the boundary of that open volume. The closed surface S bounds the volume. So I'm going to make life simple for myself. For this open volume, I'm going to pick a spherical ball that is a sphere with all the points inside of it. And for the closed surface S, that's going to be the boundary of the ball. That's just going to be the two-dimensional surface So think of this as a spherical balloon, and you're only looking at the rubber part, not the interior. Okay, I will choose the radius of this closed sphere to be some constant radius, and I won't specify what A is. Okay, on the left-hand side, I have to take the divergence of V, but that's the divergence of the gradient of R, but that's the Laplacian of R, of 1 over R, sorry. So the integrand on the left in the volume integral is the Laplacian of 1 over R. On the right, I have the vector V, so that's the gradient of 1 over R. We'll have to work that out below. Dotted into D area. So what is a little infinitesimal area dA if you're on a sphere of constant radius A? Well, dA points out and perpendicular to the surface. That is to say, it points away from the origin. So there's an R hat for direction. And then dA magnitude is the radius of the sphere squared times sine theta times d theta d phi. So how would you ever figure that out? Well, this part of the measure is h theta times h phi times d theta d phi. So remember, h theta is just r, but if you're on a sphere of radius a, then r is equal to a, and h phi is r sine theta. So altogether, h theta times h phi is a squared sine theta, and then times the two infinitesimal angles, d theta, d phi. And dA is a vector, so it gets its vector nature from this unit vector er hat. Okay, let's work out what is the gradient of 1 over r. So that's that written down here. Again, this is easiest to do. You could do it in any system. We did it before in Cartesian coordinates, but it's easier in spherical coordinates. In spherical coordinates, the gradient looks like this. I need to take the partial derivative with respect to r of 1 over r and multiply that by er hat. And then the other two derivatives are zero. There is no theta dependence. And so when I take d by d theta of 1 over r, I get nothing. When I take d by d phi of 1 over r, I get nothing. So that knocks out these two vectors. That's why spherical polar coordinates are easiest for this problem. And the derivative of 1 over r with respect to r is negative 1 over r squared. And then I need to multiply that by er. So here it is. This is negative 1 over r squared and then multiplied by er hat. So that goes in here. That integrand gradient of 1 over r is this, negative er hat over r squared. And so I plugged it in. This is v. And this is dA. And now you can see what happens. There's an a squared in the denominator because this r squared must be evaluated on the surface, and the surface is a sphere of radius a. So that r squared becomes a squared. But then there was an a squared in the numerator that was part of the measure dA, and those two a squareds will cancel. And then I have an er hat dotted into itself, and er hat is a unit vector, so er hat dot er hat is 1. And you wind up getting this negative sign out in front. And the integrals over theta and phi of sine theta d phi give you 4 pi. So that's just telling you that there are 4 pi stair radians in a sphere. If you integrate all the way around a sphere in two dimensions, you get 4 pi. But the important point is it's a constant and there is no A dependence. The A, the radius of the sphere, canceled out. So if I took as my volume this open volume on the left in the divergence theorem, if I took a sphere of radius, I don't know, 1 light year, I would get negative 4 pi. But if I took a smaller sphere of radius 1 mile, I would get negative 4 pi. If I took a sphere of radius 1 angstrom, I would get negative 4 pi. So no matter how small you make the red sphere, the answer is always negative 4 pi. That's why I said this Laplacian of 1 over r was such a remarkable function. It's concentrated at the origin. Well, we've met that before in this course. That sounds like a delta function. And in fact, the Laplacian of 1 over r is negative 4 pi times this. This is a three-dimensional Dirac delta function. This 3 in parentheses in the superscript doesn't mean cubed. It means it's a shorthand for the three-dimensional Dirac delta function. It takes different forms in different coordinate systems, and I will show you two. If you write this three-dimensional Dirac delta in Cartesian coordinates, it's simply the product. It's a delta function in x times a delta function in y times a delta function in z. I'll show you that on the next slide. If you were to write this three-dimensional Dirac delta function instead in spherical polar coordinates, then it would be a delta function in r divided by r squared. And if you're asking yourself, how would I ever figure that out? I'll show you how to do that on the next page. But there is no delta of theta angle, and there's no delta of phi azimuthal angle. It's just a one-dimensional delta of r, but then divided by r squared. All right, let's check to make sure that's true. If I take the Cartesian form, so copy that blue box into here. This is the integrand. And then integrate over all space. Integrate over x from minus infinity to plus infinity. Integrate over y over the same range. Integrate over z over the same range. So I'm integrating over all possible Cartesian coordinates. When I wrote down the integral, I forgot to include the measure. So here it is, times dx, dy, dz. But the integral will factor. So I can take the negative 4 pi out in front. Those are constants. And then I get this. This is a one-dimensional integral over x from minus infinity to plus infinity, delta of x dx. So now you have to remember back to the second or third week of classes. This Dirac delta function is piled up where the argument is equal to zero. So this is piled up at x equals zero. And I certainly included that. When I integrate from minus infinity to plus infinity, I definitely integrate over x equals zero. And so this entire integral in the blue box is just equal to one. And the same is true in the y direction. I definitely integrated over y equals zero. That integral will be one. And the integral over z is also equal to one. So I get negative 4 pi times 1 times 1 times 1, which is negative 4 pi. All right, so that tells me that this form for the Cartesian three-dimensional Dirac delta function is correct. It's giving me the right answer. The right answer is negative 4 pi on the right-hand side. All right, let's do it in spherical polar coordinates. So the claim is that the integrand is negative delta of r over r squared. So copy and paste, take that blue box and copy it into the integrand over here. And again, integrate over all space. That means I need to integrate radius from the origin out to infinity. Remember, r, this spherical coordinate is positive definite. And then I need to integrate over angle from the north pole, where theta is equal to 0 radians, to the south pole, where theta is equal to pi radians. And then integrate over all azimuth from phi equals 0 to phi equals 2 pi. And don't forget the spherical measure, this combination of symbols. This is dv in spherical polar coordinates. It's r squared sine theta dr d theta d phi. Well, you can see this r squared in the denominator is going to cancel that r squared in the measure, in the numerator. And again, the integral will factor. And so you get the integral as r goes from 0 to infinity of a delta function of r, and you definitely included the place where the delta function is piled up at the origin. So this will just give you one. There's a minus sign out in front of everything, so altogether minus one. And then the integral over theta gives you two. You can do that for practice. The integral of sine theta is just negative cosine theta. And the integral over phi, you can do in your sleep. The integral from 0 to 2 pi d phi just gives you a factor of 2 pi. So as promised, the integral over solid angle for a complete sphere is 4 pi. But there's a negative 1 out in front. And so again, the right-hand side is equal to negative 4 pi. But that's exactly what we got in Cartesian coordinates. And that's what we've got up here as well. So that's a proof that this form for the three-dimensional Dirac delta function in spherical coordinates is correct. It's delta of r over r squared. And we are done because the next part of the notes involve Gaussian integrals, but I sent you the notes and sent you a video for that before, and so that's it for today.